And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.
Hello and welcome to Action Packed, the travel podcast. I'm Peter.
And I'm Felice.
Together we've spent half a lifetime travelling to just about every corner of the world, making a living as travel writers out of what we like doing best.
And that's skiing, biking, beaches, hiking and a whole lot more.
Each week, Action Packed gives us the opportunity to share with you on the show some of these great experiences and the amazing people we meet along the way. Right now, real travel is limited to a daily walk around our local park, but the world will one day return to normal.
Meanwhile, dreams are risk-free and they're always available. You can find out more about us on our website, actionpacktravel.com. We'll regularly be posting links and show notes and loads of other useful stuff. If you like what you hear, please click on the subscribe button and listen to more episodes.
This week we're talking to Paul and Linda O'Halloran. Paul's a doctor and a keen cyclist. He wanted to take time out from his GP practice and pedal rather further afield than his native Hampshire. For years he'd been planning his ultimate sabbatical on the other side of the world, a grueling tour of Sri Lanka and Southeast Asia. And then he met Linda. Would she join him? Was it make or break for their new relationship? Paul and Linda, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Peter and Felice. Good to be here.
It's a little while back since you did this, but you cycled around Sri Lanka and then later around Vietnam, Laos and Cambodia. Why?
Well, that's a really good question, actually. I think probably why is different for both of us, but certainly for me, I've always enjoyed cycling and the opportunity to get away and think and just try and, I suppose, focus on the now was a great opportunity. And for me, once in a lifetime, in the sense of I managed to get some time out of work. And before this, I'd only really had, you know, the standard week, 2 weeks holiday, whereas this was an opportunity to do some real travel. So for me, it was very much a time to think, reflect, and enjoy some cycling and see some people and meet some people and experience bits of the world I hadn't been to before. Enjoy the whole package of time, really. I'm not sure about Linda.
I was lucky because I did have time on my hands, which was brilliant, and Paul had introduced me into cycling quite subtly and saying, yes, Linda, you can cycle 60 miles to Portsmouth. Really? But then I did, and it was fun, and I enjoyed it. And then the opportunity to actually spend a chunk of time together exploring new places on the bicycle. And he persuaded me that it would be warm, which was a big criteria for me. Actually, that didn't quite turn out that way, but it was, yes, I was completely up for the whole adventure. But entrusting Paul to know how to build a bike, what we should be doing, where we were going to go, but I was completely up for it.
So what were the logistics of flying with bikes? I mean, how do you take them on a plane, for example?
Well, the thing about taking any bike, it depends really on how sturdy the bike is. I'd specced up some bikes that were pretty sturdy. But even so, plane handling companies are famous for destroying anything in their path, bikes being no exception. So we ended up spending quite a lot of time packaging the bikes. We'd bought some tough sort of suitcases for them to go in. Although, interestingly, the suitcases I bought, which were rigid bags, we decided eventually we couldn't use because there's nowhere to store them at the end. And so you end up having to have somewhere where you can store all your packaging to bring them back again. And so logistically, it was a bit of a problem, but easily overcome with a bit of thought.
Tell me about the bikes, first of all. You needed something a bit special for this, did you?
Well, I thought so. What I'd done, I'd spent quite a bit of time talking to friends who'd done some touring around Europe and around bits of Australia and America. Of course, we were planning on going quite a long way off the beaten track. And so I wanted a bike that was firstly capable of coping with rough roads, secondly capable of carrying a fair chunk of weight, and thirdly that was going to be reliable. So yeah, I spent quite a bit of time making sure that the gears, I ended up getting some things called Rohoff gears, which are gears in a hub at the back. And they are famously fit and forget. They're so reliable. The brakes, for example, I wanted disc brakes because of the weight. But again, it was a cable rather than anything more complicated, and the frames were very solid with a front suspension, but no rear suspension. Again, everything was designed to just go and just work and have no issues, hopefully, at all. And in fact, interestingly, we pedaled the bikes for 4 months each and didn't have a single mechanical. I had a little bit of oil from my gear, which dripped onto the rear disc brake. But apart from that, they were superb.
No punctures or anything like that on the way?
Not even one puncture, which for a cyclist is unbelievable, because usually we end up with a puncture quite frequently. So yeah, not even one puncture.
So what did you take with you? I mean, it really makes you think very carefully about your possessions, doesn't it?
Yeah, what sort of things could you take with you? I mean, in the way of clothes and things like that.
Well, we went through an essential list, and the prime criteria is going to be the minimum amount of weight, because I've never done this kind of cycling before, and we have two panniers each mounted on the back of the bike and another pannier on the handlebars. So it was a case of trying to figure out what's the least weight. So we have one change of shorts, we have the lightest tops, we have a couple of cycling tops, and also we're going to have to wash stuff, obviously, so taking the smallest amount of some sort of powder that we can use when we do get to a place where we can actually wash anything. I have to say, we probably didn't smell that nice through the whole trip, but we coped.
I think you smelled better than I did, in fairness. One thing which I had planned was to take a washing line with us, and it worked really well. The first few places that we stayed were quite smart hotels, and so they were able to wash stuff for us. But the first slightly more downmarket place we stayed, where I wanted to wash our own clothes, I rigged up the washing line, put the clothes out to dry. Everything went really well, other than I left the washing line in the hotel afterwards, so I never used it again. Very frustrating. But it proved the concept, even if not the ability to actually remember to take stuff with us.
So in terms of a luxury item, what sort of thing did you take with you? I think you took a laptop, did you?
Yeah, for me it was the laptop, because I needed to work out vaguely where we were going and have some idea of the hotels or the guest houses or wherever we could be staying. But the mixture of the laptop and my little sat nav on the bike made my navigation role much, much easier. We had a couple of mobile phones, but usually the batteries weren't lasting very long. We did manage to download some maps, one website called maps.me, which we got from another backpacker, was brilliant, because it didn't use any data. So it allowed us to navigate a little bit, although of course, if you're wandering around the back reaches of Laos, the mapping isn't great. And certainly the idea of working out where hotels are, it's great if you're in tourist areas, but as soon as you get out of the tourist area, the data really isn't that great. But for me, it was a laptop and the navigation system.
Yes, my luxury item was my camera. So a big part throughout the day was recording where we'd been, things we'd seen. And it was interesting between the two of us, at the end of each day, we would download and look at all of our pictures. Some I'd taken on my phone, which was perhaps easier to hand sometimes. If suddenly I saw something cycling along, thinking, I've got to get a picture of that. One being, I remember we were in Vietnam, and horrifically, I saw this, there's no wildlife there. And I saw this man parked by the side of the road with his rifle aiming at, there was one egret that was sitting in the field, and this man was going to shoot the egret. I was going to take a picture of this egret sitting on this buffalo. So the camera was the big thing for me, and we shared and compared lots of photos, had lots of different experiences to look at the end.
So give me an idea of the overall journey. You started in Sri Lanka, you got off the plane in Colombo, you picked up your bikes off the luggage carousel, put them together, and then what? You just pedal down the road and off into the greatest adventure of your lives?
I've done quite a lot of cycling, but I haven't done any long distance cycling in sort of second world, more remote places. And so what we decided to do was pay for a guide for the first bit of the Sri Lanka trip. So, and this is very much a company, it was called Spice Roads, which anyone can sign up to. They're superb. They hold your hand, they give you the routes, they book the hotels, and they offer a guide on the road as well. So it was a very easy way into starting cycling. So we had 2 weeks around Sri Lanka with them, and then we had 2 weeks completely by ourselves. And so the idea was that we would get into the way of things with the guide, and then that would we could use that time to learn the local traditions and some perhaps some local language. For me, actually, it was more importantly about how much things cost, because I don't like the idea of not knowing that, I know, a beer costs £2 and or some street coconuts cost about £1. I don't like being the concept of just not knowing or possibly being ripped off in foreign countries. So that worked really well.
What was the typical food you ate in Sri Lanka? Did you like it?
We loved the food. Lots and lots of curries. Never too hot, actually. Often accompanied by some really interesting green beans, but it was really easy food, good calories for the cycling. So no, we were treated quite well with food in Sri Lanka. It was brilliant.
One of the things I remember really clearly about Sri Lanka were the coconut flour curries, and they were absolutely beautiful. And there was the standard meal might be five or six different curries with some pulses and some rice. And the whole thing was delicious, actually. Absolutely, the food was great.
The question that doesn't usually get asked in interviews with such intrepid travellers is curry, cycling, presumably a distinct absence of roadside loos. However did you cope?
Through the whole trip, really, between the two of us, there really was not an issue with any kind of stomach upset. I think a little bit of indigestion once for me, but nothing really... There was nothing insurmountable. Actually, there was a little bit, wasn't there? There was a time when, yes, I had to dash into the bushes, which you really don't want to. But yeah, needs must sometimes. But fortunately, it didn't last for too long and we didn't feel unwell. So we could still cycle. It was okay. We managed on that one.
Of course, Paul, you're a doctor, a GP. So did you have a big medical bag with you?
Well, I was going to say one of the other luxuries, which we never actually really used, I did take with me a selection of well-chosen tablets, a mixture of painkillers and anti-malarials and anti-diarrhea tablets, some antibiotics and some fluid rehydrating powders and things, most of which we didn't need. As Linda said, we had small episodes of diarrhea, but normally lots of fluid and it just evaporated. I think we were pretty careful. We tried to eat as much local food as we could. And in general, the more locals are eating the food, the less likely it is to be sitting around for months and months in a pot somewhere. So often you could see the food actually being cooked in front of you on the street, and that usually worked out very well.
In Sri Lanka, did you try any other sports apart from cycling? Obviously,
we had an opportunity to do some white water rafting. And I really was extremely reluctant to attempt to do any of that. And actually, I did do it. And it was one of the best things, one of the highlights of the trip in Sri Lanka, actually. Except I did end up bringing some little creature back with me, which I didn't realise at the time, as I noticed that I was bleeding profusely down my thigh. And Paul, being the doctor, said, well, that's thinned blood. And actually, we realised I'd had a leech on me. And that was one of the handicaps of in Sri Lanka. Actually, there are a lot of leeches. So you have to be very careful when you step off the road onto the side to do nature's business. And you might come back with a few of them around your ankles and up your legs.
Yeah. I think the secret is to not be stationary for too long. Yeah. Because as soon as you're stationary, the leeches can smell the warmth of your blood. And they'll start running over towards you quite quickly in a sort of slinky sort of way. And if you move, they're fine. They won't catch up with you. But if you're stationary for more than 30 seconds,
they're up your leg.
They start crawling up your leg. Yeah.
Sounds very unpleasant, but I'm sure you managed it. Tell us about where you stayed long way. Well, first of all, how far did you cycle each day? And then where did you stay?
Yeah, the distance depended a bit, really. I mean, what we tried to do was a day of cycling or 2 days of cycling and then a day of rest so that we actually had a chance to see some of the countryside that we were in. didn't always work. In general, it was maybe 50, 60 kilometers a day, sometimes as much as 130, 140, if we ended up having to get somewhere else because there was nowhere else to stay. But in general, I guess, on average, it was probably 60, maybe 70 kilometers, depending on the meters climbed as well.
That's quite a lot when you consider the amount of weight on your... Do you know how much the laden bike weighed?
Yeah, I weighed mine before we started, and it's about 25 kilos.
It was also quite hard sometimes with the temperatures across Sri Lanka, when I do recall trying to cycle along and actually counting the distances between posts, because it was so hot and it was so heavy and we were so slow, and then trying to take the lead in front of each other to try and help each other out. So it was quite grueling with the temperatures sometimes.
Where did you stay? The sort of quality of accommodation in Sri Lanka?
I think in fairness, Sri Lanka was great compared to other places we went to. In general, the quality of the accommodation was fantastic. There's lots, it's a small island relatively, so you're never far away from somewhere good. We did stay in one place just north of Colombo called the Kite House, which was much more of a tent. I think that was $7 a night, something like that. So it's hardly, not expensive, but right on the beach and a great position, lovely people. But the rest of the hotels were probably fairly, I know, 2-3 star, very civilized and very much what people would expect. The more touristy places were, you could be in England, actually, everybody spoke English so well. There was the opportunity to have some English food if you wanted to. But again, off the beaten track was for us much more real and much more interesting, and actually more difficult to get to as well.
So after 4 weeks, this was a kind of trial run in some ways. After 4 weeks, you flew home for Christmas.
Absolutely.
Enjoyed the turkey.
Recovered a bit.
And then went straight out to Vietnam.
Absolutely. Yeah.
For 3 months.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
So were you reluctant to get back on the road?
Oh, not at all. No, we were very keen to get back away. I mean, it's January in England. Who wouldn't want to be going off to another adventure to somewhere hot? As it turned out, wasn't quite as hot, because our first little excursion in Vietnam, we did have an organized trip, again, to get us into the flavor of things and see how things were. And that actually, it was cold temperatures. It was cold and damp and misty and not at all what we'd expected.
So did you have enough clothes with you?
If we wore all our layers, absolutely. Pretty much wearing every single item from the panniers.
This was one challenge actually for the bikes, because we didn't know we were going anywhere really cold. In theory, we weren't. We were going somewhere temperate and above. And so being warm usually wasn't the problem. Being dry was definitely a problem. So we had a waterproof layer, we had a couple of base layers, we had a couple of shirts. But being cold, we didn't think was going to be a problem. Going into Luang Prabang in Laos, it ended up being the coldest February on record. And it was unbelievably cold. It should be 18, 20 degrees. It was 2 or 3 degrees. It was unreasonably cold. And so we really struggled. Literally, as Linda said, we were wearing everything we had. If we had a duvet or if we had a sleeping bag, we would have worn that as well, because we were so cold. So it was a challenge packing enough clothes for different bits of the weather.
So once you left your guide behind and ventured out on your own, that's when it got tougher, right?
Absolutely, yeah. The big benefit of having a guide was we didn't need to make a decision where we were going and didn't need to make a decision where we were staying. So as soon as the guide left, we had to get some idea of a route. We didn't necessarily want to plan our routes in such detail for the next few days. So it was very much planning on vaguely where we were going and vaguely where we were staying, not knowing how far the next hotel might be or the next guest house might be, or even if there was a guest house at all. And that was one of the problems. And we also didn't really want to stay on major roads, because obviously lots of big lorries, lots of very fast cars, lots of bonkers people on roads. Whereas if we can go down back roads, it's slower, but a lot safer. So it was logistically difficult.
And we soon learned that every opportunity, especially going across Cambodia, there was a place to buy water. We needed to top up, because we honestly did not know it could be another 50 kilometers before there was another place. and we certainly were not in a place to start trying to drink tap water or anything that's being offered by locals. So yeah, that was a big thing.
At one point you went to Hanoi on your bikes. What was that like? Must have been really busy.
Brilliant. It was actually really good fun. Because because everyone's on bikes and scooters and it's like a shoal of fish. So you just feed in with the shoal and you just wind and bend with the rest of them. So it's absolutely fine. It was actually quite exhilarating and good fun. I enjoyed that part.
Once you got to know the rules, and basically the rule is, once you start, don't stop. If you stop and start and try and dodge people, they don't know what you're doing. So if you just slowly go forwards, generally they'll avoid you. Not always, unlike Phnom Penh, where Phnom Penh, I think, is the exact reverse, where it's very fast cars, not lots of scooters everywhere, whereas if you just go slowly out, they will run you over. So Hanoi was great fun.
And what about crossing borders? Was that easy?
Yeah, I think one border for me particularly, going from Cambodia back into Vietnam, I remember really clearly, and that was really, really hard work. We were told that there's going to be a $2 American fee just to have your temperature taken. And we thought, well, this is crazy. Why would we have a $2 fee? But we accepted that's what we were going to do. And it ended up being $15, but the alternative was to be there for about 6 hours. So we pay the money and walk through. Quite scary at times. Inscrutable people looking at you, not wanting to speak a word of English, going through a very quiet border. And really, they're just being paid to sit there. So they're very, very happy for you to be there for as long as they choose, which can be for hours and hours sometimes. Being on a bike actually, I think, helped because we weren't judged. So that was actually quite nice.
So the sun had come out by now and it was warmer, was it?
Going from Vietnam into Laos, we had some lovely days of weather. It was going into Luang Prabang that was really, really cold. And then having spent 4 or 5 days in Luang Prabang, which is an amazing place, everybody should go there once. It's on the Mekong. It's an old French colonial town and it's beautiful. It's full of really interesting temples. The monks live there and come out every morning to get their food. It's superbly interesting. Having left Luang Prabang, we then went down south, followed the Mekong down to Ventiam and then Savannakhet, and then it suddenly someone turned the heat on. It went from 2 degrees up to 35 degrees in the space of one day. We came out of the mountains, down onto the plain, and from then on we wished it was a little bit colder. It would have been lovely.
Yeah, one of the days that we had to plan was to cross a river, which we thought there's meant to be a ferryman there, but we knew that we had to get a lot of kilometres under our belt, I think over 100 that day. So we had to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to get to the ferryman, to get across the river to start pedaling, because by 9, 10 o'clock it's going to be up to 35 degrees. So it's a bit of planning to try and get as many kilometres under our belt before it got too hot.
You're taking a huge amount of exercise. You therefore need to put in a lot of calories, I guess. What about the food along the way?
For me, one of the best meals is when you most need it. And again, it was in Cambodia for me. And Paul was a lot more hesitant about sampling some of the street food than I was, because actually I realized, and he soon realized, that if I didn't have the calories in, I just stopped. I hit a wall and stopped, and I just couldn't carry on. And we ended up in this little village, and there was a bit of street food going on, and it was a huge big cauldron of bones and stock and indescribable things you didn't really want to look too closely at. But I absolutely loved it. It was a savoury broth, and Paul was forced to eat it because this is all we have. And he really didn't want to look too closely at the contents. But for me, it was the best thing ever. And it was like a switch turning back on again. I was then ready to cycle and okay.
It was quite amusing because we'd be sort of chatting away and for kilometre after kilometre. And then suddenly Linda wasn't there. She was half a mile behind me and she literally just stopped. And I knew then that the fuel tank was empty and she needed something. Now, usually we weren't anywhere able to actually buy food. So we had to take with us stuff. And the only reliable stuff we've managed to find were things like packets of crisps, which are fairly grim on a bike, but lots of bananas, lots of fruit, some bread rolls, which we would make up for lunch, and anything else that we vaguely recognised as food on the way, and as much water. I said 25 kilos, but sometimes we might have 5 or 6 kilos of water on board as well. Some of the roads ended up being almost no traffic, almost no people there at all, so buying water was completely impossible.
There was one meal that I particularly looked forward to. We had gone through a little town, there was a market going on, and there was this whole pile of eggs that looked like they'd been boiled eggs, been cooked. And I was given a little twist of a little wrapper with some salt and pepper and lime juice. I thought, oh, delicious, a couple of hard-boiled eggs when we stopped for our lunch. I was so fed up with bananas, they really don't hit the spot. Anyway, we a few hours into the trip, into the cycling along, I'm thinking, stopping, yes, great, I'm going to have my hard-boiled eggs. And I cracked open the first egg, and there was a little chick inside there. So the embryonic chick with its soft beak and not fully formed feathers. And I thought, oh, okay, it's just an old egg. Try the other one. No, it's the same thing. It's another little chick. This, of course, is what they like eating. Yeah. But even as hungry as I was, I couldn't stomach the little chicklet. So no food for that lunch.
A local delicacy, and we've just reverted back to bananas.
I saw some pictures of yours, of a plate of worms. Did you eat those?
Bits of Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos. There's all sorts of things that you can eat if you so choose. You can have barbecued locusts, which are fine. You can have barbecued chicken's feet, which are actually really nice, and eating the little bits of chicken's feet are lovely. They're actually quite expensive. You can also have barbecued scorpion, which we didn't try, and they're actually quite expensive, supposedly. A whole bunch of worms, but also some fairly horrible things as well, in terms of bits of frogs' intestines, bits of frogs' gallbladders, all sorts of things. And of course, famously in Vietnam, dogs, which is a great tradition of eating dog, which is by local tradition quite what's the word? It's
empowering yeah. To that we witnessed the families get together to build a house, which they do very quickly, and then to celebrate the building of the house, it's quite traditional to actually then have dog meat. So we actually saw that the dog had just been slaughtered, I guess, and was being cleaned out and ready to barbecue to feed the family, which as pet lovers is quite tough to see. But
and again, it's a tradition which we struggle with, but of course it's in some senses it's not that different to eating lots of other different animals. Most of the Vietnamese most of the time are vegetarian, so I suppose in a sense it is local custom. There's also, it's considered quite empowering to eat snakes, for example, as well, which again, we wouldn't be eating a lot of snake routinely.
So at the end of a long day, when you're very tired, you've got 100 kilometres under your belt, and you don't quite know where you're going to stay, you couldn't obviously book anything in advance, you just turned up?
Yeah, sometimes we booked. If we were going, in all of these places, there's a big difference between an area where there's lots of tourism and an area where there's none. Lots of tourism, we can usually get some Wi-Fi and we can usually book with booking.com or whatever. And then that's great. We know exactly where we're going and life is easy. When we're outside a tourist area, it's much, much more difficult. You can't even necessarily work out whether the place you're trying to find or looking for is even a hotel. You're never quite sure. So it ended up being, we ended up cycling around towns and villages trying to find somewhere to stay. But often, just looking fairly helpless and hopeless, locals ended up befriending us a bit and pointing us to the right places. I remember one place on our way to Angkor Wat, being escorted to the only sort of bed and breakfasty type place by a man with a gun and an AK-47. We followed him on his moped to the only place in town, which there is no way we would have found that as a bed and breakfast. It was just a house. And in fact, having found it, I'm not even sure it was a bed and breakfast, but apparently it was. It had a...
Well, there was no breakfast. It was a room with some bars on the window, and there was a toilet, and there was a big bucket of dirty water to wash with. But it was a bed, and you could lock the door. I think a big thing for us was security at night, that you could bring your bikes in, that you could lock a door, that you could feel relatively safe. That was a part of it.
And having found it was great. Without him, we would not have found it. And then there was nowhere, certainly within 20 kilometres in any direction, that was even a village. So it was very helpful.
Did you come across bed bugs or anything else horrible like that?
I'm sure there were, because obviously some of the mattresses were particularly vile and disgusting. And it's not the most romantic for us as a couple, that we're both climbing into our little silk sleeping bag liners with the mosquito net around us. It's like, I'm trying not to touch anything on this mattress. Don't come anywhere near me. I'm completely enclosed. I'm not moving. But I think fortunately we didn't really get any nasty bites or things. I think we were as careful as we could be.
We carried our own mosquito nets with us, which we sort of tried to hook over beds, and we carried our own sleeping bag liners, and which ended up being very effective and almost no weight.
Did you have any injuries or any near-death experiences with lorries and things like that?
I think we were pretty careful with lorries. Every single time we heard or saw a lorry, it was a near-death experience, because they couldn't give a damn about where we, you know, we were just basically an insect on their windscreen generally. And that was true for Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and Sri Lanka. And in fact, Sri Lanka in a way was worse. The passenger buses in Sri Lanka are absolutely crazy, and you'd be cycling along, and on the road would be the white chalk marks of where the damage had occurred, and you'd often see five or six of these in a day, which hadn't been washed off, and it was just the evidence of carnage. In fact, the first day by ourselves in Sri Lanka, we saw two accidents, all involving tuk-tuks. The second of which, a tuk-tuk had driven into a police car, and so that's how much they. Yeah, how much carnage is on the roads. So I think we were very, very careful. And as soon as you heard a lorry come behind us, you would make sure you were well to the side of the road. You weren't, you know, you weren't swerving around and try to be as defensive as possible.
Were there any animals on the road?
Well, this is all well and good trying to get to the side of the road, apart from there's dogs in Sri Lanka particularly. There's the dogs lie in the road, which... crazy, crazy thing to do, because actually the buses and the cars don't care. So we saw lots of three-legged dogs with bones sticking out.
Another thing that was notable for me was there were a lot of... Sri Lanka is amazingly full of animals, wildlife and domesticated animals. And as Linda says, the dogs are extraordinary. They really are everywhere. In Vietnam, there's almost no animals. There are very few wild animals. There are domesticated pigs and cows and things, but it was noticeable to me how lacking in wildlife the whole of that continent, the whole of Vietnam, Laos and Cambodia. Laos less so, but Vietnam and Cambodia particularly. Very few animals to get in the way, but sadly, very few animals at all.
Or being eaten, I guess.
I think, yeah, I mean, one of the extraordinary things about Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam was the American War, as they call it, the Vietnamese War, and also the history of Pol Pot in Cambodia. So it's three countries that have been absolutely destroyed over the last few decades, and they're still suffering now. Bits of Laos have had so many bombs, so many unexploded ordnance on their land. There are still hundreds of thousands of acres they can't use because of the unexploded ordnance. And if you add then the idea of, sort of Agent Orange defoliating all of the forests, and things still can't grow now, it's a country that has been absolutely ravaged by their history. And we spent quite a bit of time in all of the areas looking at the Khmer Rouge history in Cambodia and the Vietnamese-American War, secret war in Laos and Vietnam, and it tells a shockingly awful story, quite profound at times.
Now, you became obviously wrapped in your own bubble, and you two of you going together in this remote scenery and remote place, and then I think once or maybe twice you left the bubble and met up with friends.
A highlight of our trip for us, it's you realize when you're traveling, yes, we were very self-sufficient, and we got on really well together, Paul and I, for the whole trip. But in Luang Prabang, we had arranged to hook up with a couple of really good friends, Sean and Lawrence, who had swanned in up the Mekong first class. And we went out for an amazing meal at one of the top restaurants in Luang Prabang, which actually blew our budget for the next few weeks. But the extraordinary thing was, of course, it was so cold then. And so we're sat in this restaurant, which is not geared to have even windows. And it was all open. We're sat there with as much clothing as we could. And the restaurant even lit braziers underneath the wooden tables, trying to keep us warm. But it was a very memorable meal. The three of us did choose buffalo steaks, which were delicious. Paul decided to go for the local delicacy of the Mekong river fish, which he hugely regretted, as it tasted like pond weed or pond mud.
It tasted like river. It was horrible.
But a memorable meal.
Yeah, I think that meal was almost our week's budget for food.
And great to see a good couple of friends, yeah.
As you say, a memorable meal, but bad bill.
Yeah, very bad bill. Good wine. You had some really good wine.
Paul, you love a glass of wine. Did you manage to find the occasional tipple along the way, or did you stick firmly to water?
No, well, we did have the occasional beer, like sort of every day. The beer was an absolute requirement. I mean, in Laos, they have this Laos beer where there's a requirement for every place to sell it for the same price. And so I think it was 50 cents or a dollar for a big bottle. So every night was beer. There was almost no wine. We did manage to find in Vietnam, there's an area of vines called Dalat, which actually is, well, it's not quite to European taste, shall we say. It's quite hot, it's quite dry. Some of the wines, I'm sure, are very good, but we didn't manage to find any local wine at all. But beer was a highlight to look forward to every evening. It was a cold beer, if you could possibly find one.
Did you get fed up with the food by the end? Did you wish for home cooking?
Or? Do you know, not really. And in fact, some ways, I think what we brought back with us is, I love the simplicity, especially of the Asian, the savoury broths with lots of fresh herbs, I think is one of the nicest foods ever. And coming back home, I just actually wanted to have less of everything, less of clothing, less of food stuff. It did change for quite some time my view of how we lived our lives.
I think that it was a battle with getting any food at all. And so sometimes I would be craving the pho, the savoury broths, which were salty and warm and tasty and delicious. I could eat one of those now, actually. And so, yeah, I really enjoyed those.
How many kilometres in all did you do, all the countries together?
Just under 7,000 kilometres in total.
Over a period of how long?
That's 4 months.
High point of the whole trip?
Really hard to answer, actually. I think there were so many.
I think a highlight would be the wildlife that we did see in Sri Lanka. And I think one of those times we did do a wonderful safari that wasn't too crazy with loads of jeeps or anything. And we ended up coming alongside, there were two elephants. There was a mother elephant, and standing below her, the tiniest baby elephant that was actually suckling from the female's breast. And it was the most extraordinary moment to be that close and to witness in the wild, here's an elephant that's surviving, is reproducing. That for me was pretty amazing.
And I think my highlight actually was when we were cycling up the east coast of Vietnam. We'd had day after day of hard weather and wind on our nose, and it was raining and horrible. And we were cycling up to Hoi An, which is quite a touristy, lovely city, and we were really looking forward to it. But I'd made a few decisions about the route, which I wasn't sure was going to work because our map stopped. And I thought we might be on the wrong side of a river. And we were soaking wet, cold and miserable. And a girl passed us on a little moped. And she said, in quite good English, "Are you okay? Are you lost?" And I said, "I hope I'm not lost. I hope that's the way to Hoi An." She said, "Yes, it is. It's about 15 kilometers. Great." And we were cold and wet and miserable. So she zoomed on, didn't think anything of it. About 5 minutes later, she came back. And we thought, oh, I recognise her. We'd just spoken to her. Wonder what she's come back for. and she'd gone into Hoi An and bought us some waterproof capes because we looked so cold and miserable. She gave us these waterproof capes and said, there you go, you'll be a little bit warm, a little bit dry now. Enjoy Hoi An. And I thought that was just fantastic, actually, just the completely unnecessary, the kindness of strangers. And it was, that was absolutely amazing.
And the low point of the whole trip?
I think probably for me, again, about 3 days before my high point, we'd found a hotel that actually was on the internet and looked quite good. And it took us about 3 hours to find it. And we got there and it was run down. There was no one there. We'd had a really hard day, about 130 kilometers to get there. And there was no food, there was no people. And it was just so depressingly cold and windy and barren. And I was so keen to leave that place. That was, we were miles away from anywhere and it was really
hungry.
That
the one with the toenail clippings on the carpet and the
Yeah, it was just, it had a swimming pool, but the swimming pool was dry and full of sand. And it was on a beach, but the beach was full of rubbish. And it was just everything awful about Vietnam was in that hotel.
Is there anything you wished you'd known before going on the trip?
Actually, how much fun it was, because I would have done it years before, in a way, because although it was sort of hard, it's not hard. I think it's the sort of thing that anyone can do with a little bit of spirit. It's great fun. You can choose what you do on the day. I wish I'd known how much fun it was going to be.
One tip each for anyone considering doing the same sort of trip.
Take Paul with them because he was absolutely amazing with the navigation. And I do recall one of those in Phnom Penh where I wouldn't have a clue how we're going to find this place we're going to try and stay. And he is cycling around this roundabout, absolutely chaotic with vehicles. I'm trying desperately to keep up to see him, trying to weave in also in amongst all the vehicles. He has one hand on his handlebars, the other hand on his sat nav device, trying to figure out where do we get off this roundabout? How do we figure out where we're going? It was just so impressive. So he was amazing.
Well, thank you for that. My one tip would just be do it. Take a credit card, because that's the get out of jail free card, is take a credit card.
At the time when you planned this and set off together, you'd just started living together as a couple. Quite a brave thing to do, to be thrown together under such extraordinarily intimate circumstances for such a long period. It obviously worked because you've just both got married. So congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I don't know if anyone heard, David Hockney has been sharing some thoughts and he's been reproducing some more pictures on his iPad. And his thoughts were there are two things that are most important that we need in life, and that's food and love. And absolutely, this cycling experience was topmost all the time was about food and love. And it was the strength of relationship kept us going. And the people that we met, the highlights would be the people who showed that they were keen for us to be in their country, the kids waving in Sri Lanka, the acts of kindness of people. Those were highlights for us.
Yeah. And also it does test any relationship when you're stressed. I remember when we found a little hotel in quite a big city in Vietnam and we couldn't find the hotel again. We ended up being quite cross with each other.
We'd gone out to go and get some food, we'd wandered off, and then we realised, shit, where was the hotel? Did we do a left here? Did we do a right here? We both disagreed. There were some expletives shared. It's like, I'm not cross with you. I'm just tired and angry and hungry and I want to get back to the bed.
And we were genuinely not sure we'd ever find our hotel again, because the hotel just looks, it's not a hotel that you and I would say, cool, that's obviously a hotel. It was just a house, like every other house in another million houses. It wasn't scary, but it was frustrating and it tested us.
Paul and Linda, thank you very much for coming on the show. We wish you the best for the future.
Thank you very much indeed,
thank
Peter.
You.
Please.
Thank you, it's been a pleasure.
It's been great fun. Thank you.
That's all for now. If you've enjoyed the show, do please visit our website, actionpacktravel.com, or subscribe on Spotify, Google Podcasts, iTunes, or another of the many platforms that we're on. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with at least one other person. Stay safe, and we'll see you next week.
And
And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.